The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has now convened. The Honorable Eugene G. Doherty presiding.
Good morning to all. We are calling case number. Oops, wait a minute, I got the wrong one in front of me. 424-0126, Brookins versus Akers et al. Or and Akers versus Springfield School District. Would counsel please state your name for the record, starting with counsel for the appellant?
Good morning, Judge. Philip Andrews for plaintiff appellants, Sahila Brookins as administrator of the estate of Pierre Scott Jr., and Krishana Akers as guardian of Daquan Dunn.
Mr.
Charles
Insler.
Insler and Charles Insler of Hepler Broom on behalf of the Springfield School District and the individual school district employees.
All right. Mr. Andrews, you may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. First of all, good morning to everyone. Thank you to the court for hearing this matter today. Good morning to Mr. Ansler. Judge, just as a matter of housekeeping, would you like me to use the terms plaintiffs and defendants or appellants and appellees?
Usually we defer to the trial court designations, so I'd say plaintiff and defendant.
Okay. Thank you, Judge. Your Honors, the Circuit Court's decision as to dismiss counts 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, and 3 of the amended complaint in the Circuit Court should be reversed for three reasons. One, the defendants did not engage in implementation of a policy and exercise of discretion and are thus not entitled to immunity pursuant to Section 2-201 of the Tort Immunity Act. Number two, defendants' failure to prevent the horrific stabbing at issue in this matter was administrative in nature and not a police function within the scope of Section 4-102 of the Tort Immunity Act. Finally, number three, the foreseeability of the stabbing at issue here was entirely predictable after Ms. Bias, an original defendant in this matter, was caught with a knife at Douglas Alternative School only 1 month before the stabbing at issue in this matter. Judges, I will begin with, of course, item number
Before you
one.
move on, can I ask you about the first and second point, and whether they intersect in a way? You're saying that it wasn't in the nature of police protection, wasn't that type of action. Doesn't it suggest then, by negative implication, that it would have been, when you called it an administrative matter, a matter of supervision regarding and discretion regarding discipline?
Yes, Judge. If I understand the question, so the administrators, the defendants, the school district, as well as the individual defendants, did not actually engage in the exercise of discretion. Our argument, our point, as evidenced in defendants' own affidavits, the affidavits of defendant Wynn. Those affidavits and the facts in this case indicate that defendants did not engage in any actual discretionary act and therefore are not entitled to immunity under 2-201 as well.
Help me out though. What was the administrative function that you're saying that they did that was not police protection? Let's accept the premise that it wasn't a police type action. What was the administrative action that they took?
Judge, the administrative, our position is that there was no administrative action.
Okay, well, then that first guy who was talking a couple minutes ago said there was.
Judge, I'm sorry. To clarify, I stated that the issue in this suit is not administrative in nature. I did not say that there was an affirmative administrative act that takes this matter outside the scope of 4-102. I'm just saying this is entirely not within the purview of 4-102.
I know, but your arguments have to live with each other. So you say it was not that police type action, and your earlier words were it was purely administrative. So what was the action?
Judge, the action was inaction. The defendants failed to act.
Isn't it the whole point of your case is that they made a decision to move this child from one school to another?
Yes, Judge, that decision had been made several months before Ms. Bias was found with a knife in October of 2021. She had been attending Douglas Alternative School beginning the spring of 2021. There was an administrative decision to have her split her time, but at issue in this suit, in our amended complaint, and in this appeal, is the defendant's lack of action following October 18th, 2021, when she was found with a knife, to allow her to
Okay.
continue that individualized education program wherein she would split her time between the two schools.
So your position is we don't have established by affidavit that there was an exercise of a discretionary decision that led to that it was inaction.
In action, yes, following that October incident wherein Ms. Bias was found with a knife.
Okay.
To continue with our first point here, defendants, to just piggyback right off of that, defendants have failed to carry their burden to show that they have, in fact, exercised discretion and are entitled to immunity pursuant to Section 2-201.
Counsel, if I may, and it's somewhat of a follow-up on Justice Doherty's point, but I guess it's also a point of clarification for me. In the amended complaint, it appears to me that the plaintiff fails to delineate which defendant made which decision, but I also appreciate with regards to your response to Justice Doherty, it's in action. So, or which defendant failed to take a particular action. The amended complaint seems to lump that all together, and suggest it's just generally willful and wanton conduct. Why is that sufficient, if you will?
Yes, Judge. That's well, the what's on appeal here is the circuit court's decision pursuant to 619A9 to grant the defendant's immunity. The circuit court did not dismiss the amended complaint pursuant to 615 based on a sufficiency of pleading argument. That said, the allegations in the amended complaint describe the circumstances that we are discussing here today, that Ms. Bias was found with a knife and had a track record of aggression, and she was allowed to continue attending and roaming Lanphier High School freely in possession of a knife, and that all of the defendants, I think, to answer this, put a punctuation on this to answer your question, all defendants had an opportunity to act. The school board generally, as the entity governing, and the individual defendants all had the opportunity to act, yet failed to do so.
You see the unusual position that puts the defendant in, though, because the defendant, and let's put aside the one sentence where you're correct, he can't argue with your complaint. That's pretty much black letter law. But if you had just made a mistake and said these people, screwed up here. And you listed the name of the janitor who's got nothing to do with anything, just by mistake. They would be stuck with that. So they couldn't file a motion saying the janitor exercised discretion. They would have to speak more globally, saying the decision to do this is one of discretion. Do you understand? Do you see the position they're in both accepting the facts that you've pleaded and then advancing that affirmative defense?
Yes, Your Honor. I think a case that defendants themselves cite in their response could provide guidance as to that, you know, that item you just asked about. Haskell v. Williams, 2013, Illinois App, 4th District, 121-131, provides an example of defendants carrying their burden as moot to show that they are, in fact, entitled to immunity. They accepted the allegations, and they provided two affidavits. The superintendent, as well as the principal of the school, each provided an affidavit saying, here is our multi-factor analysis that we go through to implement discipline, and this is what we followed.
How do they do that for a person who had no input on the decision? Because they've got to accept your allegation that they did.
Well, if the nature of someone's role, you know, for instance, you suggested the janitor, but if any of these other individual defendants actually had no authority whatsoever, they could have pled that.
Yep, it wouldn't help them in this motion because they've got to accept your allegations. And if your allegations are factually wrong, the defendant is in a kind of a trick box. You froze for a second there. Hope we didn't miss anything.
Okay, I believe I heard your question. Well, the nature of a 619 motion accepts all allegations is true. But again, if the defendants had no authority to exercise discretion as to any kind of student related matter, then that could be argued, that could be provided in an affidavit as potentially another, a separate affirmative matter within the scope of 619A9. But that's not what the defendants argued. The defendants argued that they are entitled to immunity due to the exercise of discretion. Judge, as I was saying, Haskell v. Williams provides examples of affidavits that accept allegations as true and thoroughly and with detail lay out the basis for the defendant's immunity. The superintendent and principal each provided an affidavit saying this is our multi-factor analysis that we go through. And that is exactly what we follow in arriving at our decision in this case. They use very specific language to clarify what exactly they did in that particular case. In our case, we have no such language in any of these affidavits. We have conditional language based on hypotheticals. We have express denials of having exercised discretion. And defendant Wynn's second affidavit, in paragraph 9 of that affidavit, defendant Wynn expressly states that even if the defendants had wanted to exercise discretion and expel Ms. Bias, they would not have been able to. A Supreme Court case relied on by Haskell, Mulvey v. Carl Sandburg High School, both cases that defendants cite in their response. The Herenak case, it's Herenak v. 161 North Clark Street, Limited Partnership 181, Illinois 2D335, 1998. It's a Supreme Court case, an Illinois Supreme Court case, wherein the Supreme Court establishes that not only do the defendants need to hold policymaking and or discretionary positions where they can exercise discretionary decisions, discretionary decision making, but two, it's a two-factor test, but two, they must show that they were actually engaged in such action to be entitled to immunity pursuant to Section 2-201. And Haskell.
Counsel, if I can interrupt just for a second. So I anticipate the defendants are going to argue that this is the type of decision that of letting her back in the school that just is automatically discretionary and would meet the test. And so therefore they don't have to spell out the specifics. And if I'm hearing you correctly, that's required.
Yes, sir. It is required.
Okay. Right. Also, I'm sorry. You may continue.
Yes, sir. In addition to the fact that it's required as a matter of law pursuant to Heron Act, and multiple cases cited by defendants themselves. Again, as I was saying a few minutes ago, just because in the nature of disciplinary decisions may be inherently discretionary, one, of course, they're required to show that they are engaged in that, but two, in a case such as this, they're what we're saying, our point, is that the action was inaction. They simply failed to act. So even if a discretionary decision or a disciplinary decision may be inherently discretionary, when no decision whatsoever is made due to inaction, such defendants, such administrators are not entitled to immunity. So that's the other side of that. Now, to go through those affidavits, defendants not only do not show that they were not actually engaged in discretionary decision making after Ms. Bias was found with the knife, but they expressly state that they did not. Affidavit one says, supposing plaintiff's allegations were true, defendants would have weighed various factors as prescribed by policy. As I said a moment ago, the second affidavit states that even if defendants had wanted to, they would not have been able to, administer whatever decision they would have liked to.
Isn't that limited to suspension?
They state that that is in the context of exclusionary discipline, but that's the point. They were not able to exercise whatever discretion that they would have exercised based on the multi-factor tests. And in stating so, defendants basically walk a fine line between they don't want to admit that they didn't exercise discretion, but they can't outright say, like the defendants in Haskell, this is what we did in this case, because they didn't do anything in this case. They simply failed to act, despite their knowledge that Ms. Bias had recently been found with a knife, had a very extensive track record of aggression and belligerence and disruption.
Careful you don't win the battle and lose the war, counsel. I mean, if it's true that they have no legal authority to suspend under these circumstances, it seems as though you probably ought to have another should have action that you're arguing for. You should be telling us, well, what is it that you're saying they should have done?
They should have, I mean, done anything that would have limited biases.
Nope. My torts teacher was very insistent. Negligence is conduct. Wrongful conduct has to be described. So tell us, what was it they should have done? That's pretty fundamental to your claim.
Yes, sir. The defendants could have implemented any kind of discretionary or any kind of specific discipline or program, or adjusted Ms. Bias's individualized education program to limit her ability to roam Lanphier freely or to attend Lanphier to the extent that she had been. What's at issue here is that after she was found with a knife, she was able to just roam that school without supervision in possession of a knife. And that's the proximate cause.
That begins to get a little more into that police protection type of thing, doesn't it? Without supervision?
No, sir, because unlike the cases cited by defendants in their response, Ms. Bias's curriculum or ability to walk around Lanphier, what classes she attends, where she goes at what times and supervised by who, would be within the scope of school administration and not a police function.
You got cases that say that for supervision, for safety reasons?
Judge, I do not have a case off the top of my head, but as movements, defendants argued that the cases Green and Albert that they cite render this matter or illustrate that this matter falls within the scope of Section 4-102. And those cases are just materially inapposite.
All right. Thank you, Counselor. Your time has expired. Mr. Insler?
Thank you. May it please the court. On behalf of the Springfield School District and the individual school district employees, this is a tragic case, Your Honors. It's a case in which Ms. Bias stabbed two of her fellow students, Pierre Scott Jr., who died from his wounds, and Daquan Dunn, who survived. And their mothers then filed this lawsuit seeking damages from the Springfield School District, the individual employees, and Ms. Bias, though she would later be dismissed. Now, the law is clear even in the face of these tragic circumstances. The school district and the individual defendants are entitled to absolute immunity under Section 2-201 and Section 4-102 of the Tort Immunity Act.
Let's talk about 201 to start with. What does the record show about the actual exercise of discretion?
Yes, and so when Mr. Andrews is saying there was no discretion, that's absolutely not the case, because if you look at the Wind affidavits, and I'm at A212, paragraph 10, he painstakingly goes through all of the decision-making that it took to arrive at what discretionary decision was made with respect to Ms. Bias and the first time that they discovered the knife.
Doesn't he say what would have been done? Isn't that sort of part of the problem here?
No, he says in arriving at the decision as to what action was appropriate, we considered, it's not we would have considered, we considered what district staff to notify, whether exclusionary discipline was appropriate and permitted, what consequences would limit the likelihood she would repeat the contact, and what impact the proposed consequences would have on Mrs. Bias's education, and balancing these factors. So he's going through what factors they had to evaluate, what factors they had to balance. He's also discussing what the school code allows and what the school handbook allows for in terms of there's no zero tolerance policies permitted. They have to evaluate everything on a case-by-case basis. That is the law, and that's what the handbook permitted as well. So Mr. Wynn is absolutely going through all the factors that the school district took when they arrived at a disciplinary decision for Ms. Bias after discovering the knife on October 18th.
Does he tell us who we is?
He does. In paragraph 8, on 8 to 11, he goes through the different administrators.
Mr. Insler, wouldn't it have been easier for you and for us to make a decision in this case if each of these defendants filed their own affidavit stating what they did and how they participated in this?
I think one of the problems was that the amended complaint never alleges what each defendant was supposed to have done and how they contributed to that decision. And I think it, on some level, dismissal is proper because either one of two things happened, okay? The individual played no part in the decision-making. So take the janitor, for instance. Or the alternative, that individual made a judgment call about how to handle the situation at issue and is therefore covered by Section 2-201 because they're involved in a judgment call.
I get what you're saying.
That includes a judgment call of not taking any action?
I think not taking action. I think not taking action is a form of action because you're making a decision that maybe this, and if you look at the actual facts, what they determined was that the facts were that Ms. Bias said the knife, she was hiding the knife from her brother and hid it in her backpack and had forgotten about it. So the facts at issue were not that this was Ms. Bias bringing a knife for intimidation purposes to target any of her fellow students. It was that the knife was hidden from her brother, happened to still be in her backpack. So with those facts at hand, the administrators are making a discretionary decision. They're evaluating, how many offenses has she had? Was this a dangerous knife? Was she bringing it for intimidation? And they're making the best decision they can with the facts they have. And that is the whole purpose behind the Tort Immunity Act, is that judges and plaintiffs should not be able to come second guess what administrators are doing, because they are the ones on the ground with the most information. They know the students, they know the student body best, and they should be given that ability to make those calls without being second-guessed. And there's some discussion
about— Going back to your comment about, the janitor shouldn't be in the case if they didn't exercise discretion. I understand your point substantively, but just procedurally, that seems to be out of reach of a 619 motion because we have to accept the plaintiff's allegation that he was involved. And this is the hypothetical janitor, just to be clear.
Right, Your Honor. The amended complaint doesn't describe any circumstances particular to any particular defendant. So we moved globally because all the allegations were directed at—
Every allegation seems to be against every defendant.
Correct.
So that means that if we say, well, but this defendant didn't involve himself or herself, we're sort of arguing with the complaint, aren't we?
No, I don't think we are, Your Honor, because our motion certainly accepts the facts as pled in the complaint. And then we have additional facts brought out by the Wind affidavit. And under the 2619 procedure, if they wanted to contradict any of our additional facts, they were required to provide counter affidavits, and they never did. And I would also say that at the circuit court level, they abandoned their motion to strike Wynn's second affidavit. They were willing to just
Counsel,
take a circuit.
If I may, just briefly, because it's something that I noticed in reviewing the record, and you referenced the Wynn affidavit at, I think you're using the reference point of 210 when you cited that. I have not been able to find in the record where the second affidavit is actually notarized. So when
yes.
I look at A213, that's not notarized. When I look at the common law record of 878, that document is not notarized. Is there an affidavit in which it was actually notarized that was part of the record?
The record reflects that there's no notary public signature.
And this would be what has been referred to as the second affidavit by Mr. Wynn, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing something. Thank you.
I think that might just have been an oversight, unfortunately.
I'm looking at 889. It looks like there is a kind of cut off. But...
On the common law record?
What was your reference, Judge?
889. I believe they're kind of cut off, so it's hard to
Don't have that in front of me, but I can't speak to whether it was properly signed by the notary, but it certainly was signed by Mr. Wend.
It would have to be notarized, though, correct, to be considered by the court?
I can't speak to the case law on that. I think I can't speak to the case law on that.
You speak to the rule, though. Rule 91 specifies the form.
I mean, it's made on personal knowledge. He lays out all the reasons why the school district staff took the measures they did. And he discusses the school code, the handbook, the different factors that inform the school's discipline. And I would also say that this case can be decided without the Wend affidavits. If you look at the very face of the complaint, it describes what the defendants are alleged to have done. The amended complaint alleged the defendants made the conscious decision, and that's a decision, I want to emphasize, to reintroduce bias into the student body at Lanphier High School without adequate supervision, all the while knowing she posed a threat to other students. So those factual allegations fall into two categories. First, the defendants failed to appropriately discipline bias. And second, the defendants failed to adequately protect their sons. So each of these categories is apparent from the face of the complaint and implicates immunity. And Illinois case law has consistently held that decisions about school discipline are matters of judgment and discretion, and therefore subject to immunity. That's Castillo and Mulvey, both of which were decided without any reference to supporting affidavits.
Is this entirely a matter of discipline?
I think that's...
You could find that there was no culpability, but still that there was a risk to other students.
What the plaintiffs are alleging we should have done was appropriately, and I don't know how, you know, discipline, basically create a structure so they would protect their sons. And so I don't know if you want to call it discipline or a policy or an IEP, but they are questioning the manner in which the defendants arrived at how to handle Ms. Bias. So, you know, we call it discipline because that's kind of how the handbook refers to it, but they are questioning how the school district should have handled Mrs. Bias's education. And that is absolutely a matter of judgment and discretion. And those issues are apparent from the face of the complaint. And the same is true of the failure to protect. Illinois case law has consistently held that allegations about a failure to protect are subject to immunity. That's Castillo and Green. And Castillo and Green were also decided without any reference to supporting affidavits. So the circuit court was correct to dismiss this lawsuit on immunity grounds, and it could have done so without reference to Wend's affidavits, because the grounds for dismissal were apparent on the face of the amended complaint. Now, there's some question about foreseeability, but that is a negligence issue, and the Tort Immunity Act forecloses negligence causes of action based on that affirmative defense. I also wanted to address two of the cases that they reference in the reply brief. Those are the Doe and Domofsky decisions, and those decisions do not help the plaintiffs. In fact, they offer a helpful contrast in deciding this case. Doe concerned the furnishing of an attendant on a bus transporting disabled children. And while on the bus, the plaintiff was sexually assaulted by a child that had been declared sexually aggressive. And the protective plan at issue for that child in that bus required an attendant be there, and the attendant was not there on the day of the assault. So what we have here was a ministerial task, not a discretionary one. There were no factors to weigh, there was no judgment, there was no discretion at issue. There had to be an attendant, and there wasn't. And so Domofsky also does not help the plaintiffs. Domofsky involved allegations of sexual abuse by a teacher against a student. The plaintiffs alleged the school board was aware of past incidents by the same teacher and that the board had been negligent in that regard. And the court found there was no immunity because the board had no discretion in how to proceed. Under the Reporting Act, the board had to act on the previous reports of child abuse. So Doe and Domofsky are examples of ministerial duties where the defendants had no factors to weigh, no individual determinations to make. And that is simply not the case here. The question of how best to handle Ms. Bias's education and discipline required consideration of individual factors. I think it's helpful to just sort of play out what the defendants are asked to do if you take a situation similar to what we have here. A student who brings a knife to school, and there are a number of different factors that are going to inform that disciplinary decision. So imagine, is this a butter knife or a hunting knife? Is this for the purpose of intimidation or presentation? Is it a school presentation that's at issue? Is this a first offense or a 10th offense? Is the threat credible or not credible? Is the student 18 years old or 8 years old? Those are five questions just from one act of bringing a knife to school. So it's not, You can't simply say, Ms. Bias brought a knife. This is what had to happen. And in fact, everything says you cannot have policies in place. You cannot have zero tolerance policies in place. And you cannot mandate. There's no way to create a list of, you know, this happens and therefore this has to happen. There's no way to, you know, consider every possible permutation of school discipline. And I think that's what the plaintiffs are asking this court to do, is to figure out, you know, there was a knife that was brought to school, and this is what the school district had to do. This was a ministerial task, and they did the wrong thing. And that's simply not what the law allows for, and it's not what common sense would allow for. And looking as far back as Donaldson from this court, they said, you know, black robe judges just cannot be in the business of making school discipline decisions. It has to be left to school administrators on the ground who know the students best, who know the situation best. And there's just so many different things that they have to consider. They've got to consider the parents. They've got to consider the other students. They have to consider that student. And all those factors speak to why we have the immunity provisions that we do have in place. And I think I heard Mr. Andrews admit at certain points that disciplinary decisions are discretionary. And that's the whole case we have here. Their whole case is arguing that we made the wrong decision, but that is a discretionary decision for which we are entitled to absolute immunity. And there's nothing in the brief or the amended complaint that ever states what the defendants should have done differently. They've never said, you know, this was the proper course of action. They simply say we made the wrong decision. But again, that is the core word at issue here, decision. We are making discretionary decisions. And that is the whole purpose of both, you know, certainly 2-201. And then really when we get down to 4102, where, you know, the allegation is that we failed to protect their children. And that is the core issue with section 4-102. Did we fail to protect, you know, the two students at issue? And if we look to the, you know, it's interesting that they attack the affidavits, because that means they're not truly attacking the merits of the circuit court's immunity ruling. Instead, they're arguing about the propriety of two affidavits. And Jason Wynn's affidavits were properly before the court. A motion to dismiss under 26109 admits the legal sufficiency of the plaintiff's complaint, but it asserts affirmative defenses, and immunity is one such affirmative defense. So section 2619 expressly permitted the school district and the individual defendants to support their motions to dismiss with affidavits of Jason Wynn. And I think it's telling.
Well, that we do need an affidavit to establish that, in your mind, it was a decision, even though it was inaction, it was a decision. And it looks like what we're really hanging on is the words "we considered," which are used a couple of times in paragraph 10 of the second affidavit.
Well, I think we could decide this case with or without the affidavits, but I think the affidavits are probably, well,
the plaintiff said you didn't do anything and you never thought about it. We'd need to see the affidavit to see that you did.
I think inaction is also a form of action. That's a decision not to do anything differently would be.
It can be, but not if you're decision. Like taking a nap, right? I mean, you have to show that you thought about it and chose inaction.
I think the amended complaint lays out that there was a knowledge of what, you know, the defendants were aware of Ms. Bias, that they conducted some investigation of what had happened earlier. So I don't think there's any allegation that they just totally disregarded the situation. I think that even the amended complaint notes that there was, you know, discussion of how to handle the situation. When they say inaction, I don't think they're actually saying nothing at all. People were sleeping. There was no efforts to talk to Ms. Bias to determine what to do after that. There's some argument that dismissal cannot be based on disputed facts. It's true that an affidavit, you know, cannot deny plaintiff's allegations, but that's not what we have here. Wynn's affidavit did not deny the allegations. Instead, it raised the affirmative matter of immunity, and it added additional facts that the plaintiffs would have been obligated to submit counter affidavits on.
It did in one sentence. It denied it, and we've got a lot of trouble flowing from that. Is there any way in which your arguments are premised on that denial?
No. And I think more to the point, the circuit court's order, which that's the order being appealed from, right? We're appealing the circuit court's order, not Wynn's affidavit, does not reference any disputed facts. So the circuit court order accepts all the facts as true from the amended complaint. And so that's the order being reviewed. And so you know, to the extent that the plaintiffs are arguing that our affidavit disputed facts, none of that came into the circuit court's order.
And the second affidavit was only related to the last defendant who had not been dispensed with, correct?
Correct. That related to just
that was not filed until, because the other order had been entered with regards to the other defendants at that point, correct?
Correct. And there even was an appeal from the first order of dismissal that was then voluntarily dismissed because, right, all the defendants were not properly adjudicated. But then it, obviously the second affidavit is now part of the record, and the circuit court noted that it was granting the motion for the reasons, you know, previously discussed as well. So
the Wins affidavit is part of the record. Did the court make that ruling based upon this affidavit, the second one, as to all defendants?
No, obviously it would not have. It had already made a decision with respect to the first defendant.
There's a rule in appellate practice that we don't consider matters that were not before the court at the time of the decision.
Well, I would say, you know, there was a motion for reconsideration as well. So I think the circuit court was aware of that motion for reconsideration. And then we have the second affidavit as well. So second affidavit is certainly part of the record, and this court obviously has the ability to affirm on any basis supported by the record. And if the court has no further questions, I would yield the rest of my time.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Andrews.
You're muted, Mr. Andrews.
Forgive me. Yes, Judge, just a couple quick points in rebuttal to counsel. First, nothing in the amended complaint states that or concedes or acknowledges that defendants actually exercised discretion after Ms. Bias was found with a knife on October 18th, 2021. Counsel said that a few moments ago. That is just simply not the case. Further, I would just like to drill down a little bit further on the fact that defendants failed to carry their burden in their 619A9 motion. Counsel stated that counter affidavits were required. Counter affidavits were not required because defendants themselves did not care initially. Therefore, plaintiffs had no obligation to counter defendant's motion. The affidavits failed to state where and how defendants actually exercised discretion, what actual factors they evaluated and applied to Ms. Bias's case. They simply suggest that defendants may have exercised discretion because their positions were such that they could have. So defendants failed to carry their burden. Plaintiffs had no obligation to file counter affidavits. You know, I think counsel himself stated plaintiff's position for plaintiffs. He said not taking action is action. That's not what the case law says for defendants to be immunized by section 2-201. Again, as stated in Heronek, which is cited by Haskell and Mulvey and you know, the other case law cited by defendants themselves, defendants must hold policymaking and discretionary positions and must show that they engaged in the implementation of a policy and exercise of discretion in order to be immunized by section 2-201.
So, counsel, going back to what you said in your complaint, you said that they consciously and purposely reintroduced the child to the same students and staff, knowing that she posed an even greater threat than she did before the removal. it doesn't sound like that's just sort of a, you know, they missed it. It doesn't sound as though you're saying that everyone just kind of let it pass. It sounds like it's a purposeful act.
Judge, that portion of the complaint discusses the reintroduction of Ms. Bias prior to October 18th, 2021. It states that in the implementation of her individualized educational program, she was reintroduced to the population at Lanphier High School, you know, despite her track record.
So prior to the knife incident?
Yes, sir. Prior
okay.
to
Okay. Is that part of your claim? Are you saying that is a wrongful act that led to the damages at issue?
The initial design of the individualized educational program?
Of bringing her back to Lanphier?
No, Judge. Our claim is focused on defendant's failure to do anything after October 18th, 2021. And as we've discussed today, as illustrated in the appellate briefings, as illustrated in the circuit court briefings, defendants have failed to carry their burden pursuant to 619A9, and have failed to show that these claims should be dismissed on the basis of immunity, whether pursuant to 2-201, 4-201, or any other section.
Thank you, counsel. We will take the matter under advisement and issue a decision in due course.